Hi, this is Jen, and welcome to the latest episode of the Minorities in Publishing podcast. For new or recurring listeners, you know to find the podcast at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com or on Twitter at minoritiesinpub. It's also on iTunes, where you can listen, subscribe, and rate the podcast. I am re-recording this beginning of the episode from my apartment, so forgive me if you hear the hissing of heat in the background, which is a blessing, not a curse, and my potential noisy neighbors, those who follow me on my personal Twitter may know who I complain about on occasion. This episode was originally recorded with two people, and after editing it and sending it to both, one of them had asked to be removed for personal reasons. Out of respect for them, I did remove their section. So I wanted to make sure to preface this episode by noting that, and that if you experience that it's a bit choppier or the transition from one question to another seems a bit harried, it's because of that. And also time constraints, because I was unable to record with that person again, just the two of us. And also with upcoming episodes, those were promised to be posted for upcoming guests in a specific amount of time. So perhaps in the future that guest may return, but I did want to make sure to post this episode because I really enjoyed the conversation we all had, and I really appreciate both of them taking the time to speak to me about their experiences. But I really do think this is a strong episode with Shelley Diaz of School Library Journal, and I really do hope you enjoy it. So thanks for listening as always, and take care and see you next episode. Here's the latest.
So I'm Shelley Diaz. I'm School Library Journal Reviews Manager, and I primarily edit YA reviews for SLJ, and I also edit any bilingual or Spanish language reviews that come our way, and a few projects here and there.
And we'll definitely be talking about the baseline survey because it did have that segment of reviewers, which mm-hmm. I think is also, like I had mentioned earlier, just underrepresented, not thought about, and it kind of relates to the circuitousness of the business, of how there's a lack of diversity in every area.
That is the truth. Yes.
Sadly. How did you arrive at this area, in stage of your lives, in terms of your employment? And what are your hopes? What are your hopes and dreams? What are your hopes after seeing the results of the baseline survey? Because when I posted the baseline survey, it's interesting, and I don't know if you both had the same experience, was that certain people just didn't want to talk about it. You know, you kind of said, the results are out, and cricket.
Well, I came to SLJ after first starting my publishing career right out of college. I started at Scholastic, Inc., which for a kid who grew up on Scholastic was a dream come true. And I was there as an editorial assistant level, kind of book club assistant, the little magazines that you order books from. I was there for about a year. And then, you know, all the layoffs happened in publishing. And after that, I went to Penguin. I was an editorial assistant there for 3 years at one of the imprints in children's books. And, you know, you get to that three-year mark and you're trying to figure out what to do next. And I realized I wasn't very happy there. So I decided to go to library school. And I needed to pay for library school. So I did a bunch of little part-time jobs, book scouting, at a coloring book company. I was a managing editor there. But then I finally found this position at SLJ, which married the best of both worlds, you know, children's publishing, which I came from, and the library world where I was going towards. So I did that while I was in library school, and I've been here ever since.
And so they wouldn't pay for it?
Well,
I wonder if there's like a tie-in, because there's library marketing too, you know? Mm-hmm. So I wonder if they would.
Well, I know that they used to pay at one point, but this is definitely around all the layoffs and all the publishing cuts.
About 2008?
Yes, 2008, 2009. Yeah, so that, like, all the wells ran dry around that time. And I was already in library school when I started at SLJ, so yeah. But I was able to finish, which is great, finally. and I'm here now. And SLJ, I think, was actually the first review journal that signed up for the baseline survey.
Yeah.
And we were not surprised by the results, obviously. Mm. We kind of knew already that our reviewer pool, which pretty much are all practicing or retired librarians, are going to be as diverse as the library world, yep. which is not very diverse at all.
Mm. Yeah, sadly.
Well, I want to talk about library school because mm-hmm. there are a few people that I've spoken to who are librarians, but they aren't necessarily doing library work mm-hmm. anymore. Like Danielle, who was also on mm-hmm. the podcast, she was a librarian, and now she's doing tutoring, and she wants to do more social justice, and she's a writer, obviously. And there are a couple other people I've met who are librarians who write, mm-hmm. But not everyone's active. Like there are some people who just have those degrees, and they're kind of catching dust.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really sad thing that the public and our government and so many people in places of power don't understand the value of the library. And I mean,
and
most
have
people
an original resource for
yeah,
people.
Yeah, I mean, it's really the place. If democracy exists anywhere in this country, it exists in the library. Mm-hmm. And you need a master's degree for that?
That's yes. true. I didn't know that five, you know? 6 years ago.
Yeah. Yes.
Even for archiving. If
yes.
you
want
exactly. to become an archivist, yes. you have to get a master's in
exactly.
library science.
And if you want to be an academic librarian, you need two masters. A big reason why our field is not as diverse as it could be is because many of us who come from an immigrant background like myself, or you know, first generation going to college, you know, your family is thinking, why are you spending so much money to get educated when you can make so much more money doing
right.
things that you don't even need a college degree for,
yeah.
especially
mm-hmm.
because many of these positions don't pay very well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's just a lot of these institutional
yeah.
reasons why
yeah.
our profession is not as diverse as it could be.
What is the outreach you think people can do to get more, not just POCs, but LGBTQ,
mm-hmm.
people who are disabled,
mm-hmm.
and just different variations of representation in libraries? Because like you were saying, what we're seeing is retired,
mm-hmm.
older
yep.
white women doing
mm-hmm.
reviews who had that librarian degree. And that's a very specific mindset in terms of what is good, quote unquote,
mm-hmm.
and bad, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm. I mean, definitely ALA could do a lot more in recruiting. The younger, the better, I feel,
mm-hmm.
because as a kid, I never thought, and I think the same is true for publishing in general,
oh,
which,
yeah.
which you know, I've heard from your podcast, like almost everyone's story is, I never knew publishing was
mm-hmm.
a job that I could have when I was a kid.
Right.
And I think, especially now, more and more schools are not having actual librarians within
right.
the classroom. They might
exactly.
have a library, a room full of books,
mm-hmm.
but they don't
yeah.
have a certified librarian.
That's true.
Kids from an early age are not going to be exposed to the fact that a librarian is a profession that you could actually do
mm-hmm.
one day if you wanted to. So I think, you know, all of these organizations that, you know, we belong to, ALA, AASL, which is for school librarians, and all these other places, we could all do a better job of just recruiting the earlier the better,
mm-hmm.
And just, you know, and our library schools as well,
mm-hmm.
you know, connecting
mm-hmm.
with undergrad programs that might be good feeder programs for
mm-hmm.
the library school. We're always getting emails, call your senator to approve this budget line
yeah.
for, you know, because a lot of the funding that libraries get is federal money and
yes,
state
mm-hmm.
money,
mm-hmm.
and, library supporters, that's definitely, you know, anyone can do this, where you can contact your senator, your assemblyman, your councilman, all those local politicians, and let them know how important the library is.
Mm-hmm.
And the more people like that in places of power who hear us and hear the importance about the importance of the library, the more they can at least advocate
mm-hmm.
for more money to be given to the library.
Yeah. And I feel like people, because the library is free, people forget that people get salaries. I feel like they forget the budgeting.
Yeah, definitely.
Of they really think stuff falls from the sky.
Mm-hmm. They do.
And, oh, this is great. The library always has the books.
Right.
There's always something there. Especially the New York public library system
yeah.
is so huge, and we have the different branches.
Yeah.
and people go in and out, and I really just don't think it's understood that people need money to operate these things mm-hmm. so that you can get them for free.
Exactly. Right. And it's not only books. You know, there are movies, a lot of yeah. movies. There are also services that libraries provide, like tax mm-hmm. prep services, like notaries. They have ESL classes. They have mm-hmm. Programming for kids, you know, at the mm-hmm. earliest ages. And so many different things that the library offers. And you know, a lot of people say, oh, well, I can just find it on Google. I can find it on my phone. I can find it, you know, blah, blah, blah. But meanwhile, what about all those people that don't have access to the internet at home?
Yes.
Yep.
Yes. And don't have access to services that we take mm-hmm. for granted. And the library is a place where those services exist. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. And I think it's funny because working in academic publishing, we actually have the hardcovers and those are for the libraries. Mm-hmm. And those are the reasons why your books are 3 times as much as the paperback.
Yes. Yes.
And that's what the library is paying for.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the publishers in that context are relying on those sales.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so those are smaller print runs, I'm sure, than the paperback. Mm-hmm. So that makes it even more expensive.
Yes.
Yeah, it's insane. Even I'm in meetings at work. I said, are we seriously charging people? That makes no sense. I want to smack you.
Yes.
And you pay my rent. So speaking of money.
Money. Oh, that thing.
This is going to be the In Praise of Librarians episode. Yeah. Matt De La Pena has been one of the most outspoken advocates saying that if it wasn't for librarians, he would not have the career he has today. Mm-hmm. And I think that goes for a lot of authors, and maybe they do or don't realize it. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe children's authors maybe acknowledge that a bit more than adult mm-hmm. literary authors, because there's more of that interaction, like what you said, right. with the programming, especially with children. They might come out more in full force.
Yeah.
And so when we get to back to the diversity baseline survey, and that clearly showed the review aspect
mm-hmm.
and librarians for Library Journal. It's librarians. That's like a qualification that they have to be.
Yeah.
Okay.
We have very few exceptions, but for the most part, and I think that's what sets apart our magazines from the other literary journals, mm-hmm. review journals, is that this is a professional magazine, a professional source for librarians. And we, at least SLJ, we're the largest reviewer of children's books in mm-hmm. the world. And so for a librarian who has a lot of purchasing power, mm-hmm. we are the go-to source for the most part. I like to think that anyway. Mm-hmm. And because we have the most reviews.
Yeah.
And this is a place where if a librarian, most librarians, when they make their purchases, a lot of them have to have like 2 or 3 positive reviews, at least 1 positive review in order to purchase the book. Or at least a review that proves why this book needs to be in my collection.
Oh,
it needs to be in my building. Mm-hmm. So that if a censorship case comes along or whatever, they can say, look, it got a star review from SLJ. Mm-hmm. You know, this means that this is why I have it in the collection.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why we want to keep that reviewer base, because these are librarians who are serving their colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they know what is necessary in a library, what is going to be popular in a library, because mm-hmm. they actually interact mm-hmm. with kids and patrons. And so they can say, you know what, I don't have to read the 200 books that are appearing in this month's SLJ issue because a colleague of mine reviewed it and said this was going to, you know, fly away on the shelves mm-hmm. in my library, so I trust it.
Mm-hmm. So with regards to that, and it's very interesting because I'm glad you touched upon the purchasing power, because that's another thing that I think gets lost. I don't know. You can tell me. It seems like publishers are remembering and that there was an era where they forgot mm-hmm. the purchasing power of libraries. And I had a friend who was a librarian and said, yes, I have a $30,000 budget for my school. You know,
mm-hmm.
That's a lot of freaking money.
Yeah.
That's a lot of copies of the crossover.
Right. Yes. Right. Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
So there's the purchasing power with librarians, and like you said, the kind of authenticity of it,
mm-hmm.
when you have a librarian reviewing it over Kirkus, which is getting who knows what
mm-hmm.
dude in your MFA class reading Roxane Gay this week. You know, think she's mean. Or whatever. Yeah. So, but getting to the rate aspect, and you know, we can, you know, touch upon this, not touch upon this. I used to do reviews, mm-hmm. and it was for the startup website, and I got paid $10 or $15 a review. Mm. And the books, and it was whether the book was 90 pages or 450 pages. Wow. And yeah. obviously I didn't do that for very long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So some rates have ranged from 20 to 50, and even Kirkus's rates aren't that great.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be very succinct with Kirkus too, which can be even harder.
Right.
To say, I need to really get in mm-hmm. 250 words why this book is or is not good. And again, you know, they're doing the literary, they do children's. Mm-hmm. I don't know what their criteria is for the children's writers. I know anyone could apply.
Right.
And but these rates are so low. So then it comes back to the payment aspect of who can afford the cost-benefit analysis is what mm-hmm. I call it, of is it worth my time to get possible exposure or at least to help or da-da-da-da-da when I can just start my own blog and do these reviews and maybe people catch on, like Ebony Thomas at
right.
UPenn. She does a lot of reviews herself.
Mm-hmm.
But it would kind of be advantageous to have her as a voice in Kirkus or,
yeah.
as I mean, she doesn't have a library degree, but, you know, other outlets that are even more public. So do you feel like the payment scale is also a deterrent, or it really is the outreach or kind of both in terms of getting more reviewers?
Mm. And, you know, and we do say, and it's on our website, that actually all of our reviewers, at least in the SLJ side, they're all volunteer reviewers.
Same for LJ, too.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah. they don't get paid at all,
oh.
which could be a very big deterrent. For
right.
someone mm-hmm. who is looking especially to get their name out there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, SLJ and LJ, we definitely have the reputation. We've been around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I think Dewey of Dewey Decimal System was the one that founded us.
Oh.
So mm-hmm. there is that cachet of being mm-hmm. an SLJ, LJ reviewer. They all of our viewers get a copy of the book, like
mm-hmm.
the finished copy
oh, okay.
of the book that they review, mm-hmm. not just the galley,
mm-hmm.
which for many reviewers who have no budget to purchase books
mm-hmm.
or have a very tiny budget, they can add it to their collection.
Mm.
They can, you know, I mean, we let them do whatever they want with their book, but many of them give it to a kid who mm-hmm. doesn't have a book to bring home and have mm-hmm. a home library. So... and many of our reviewers go on to be part of Newbery Committee, Caldecott
mm-hmm.
Committee, because they have that evaluation criteria that
mm-hmm.
those committees are looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And so we hope that reviewing for our magazines lead to other things,
mm-hmm.
professional things.
Mm-hmm.
They can definitely add that to their resume and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, we don't pay for the most
mm-hmm.
part. And that as a person of color, you know, I myself, if I was in one of my reviewers' feet, I might think twice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Especially if it's a 500-page long biography.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, now that Twitter lets you do longer direct messages, there's no way in hell mine are 200.
No.
I realize 600.
Yeah.
This is Twitter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Well, speaking of the Newbery,
mm.
I feel like that kerfuffle was what it was, and you know, it faded as quickly
right.
as it came. So the Newbery is kind of the creme de la creme
yeah.
of children's literature awards. It
yeah.
is the Oscar.
It definitely is.
Of
mm-hmm.
the children's lit awards. And that gets awarded at ALA, well, I should say announced, but awarded at summer
right,
conference.
Right.
So it's announced at the Midwinter Conference.
Mm-hmm.
And Last Stop on Market Street won this year.
That's right.
By Matt De La Pena and Christian Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
Both super talented, super nice guys. And it's a picture book, and it was the second time, I believe, a picture
right,
book won that
right.
honor.
Technically, the first picture book that won the honor, and I think it's somewhere in the early 80s, mm-hmm. was a collection of poetry or verses.
Oh.
So there's been debate about whether Last Stop is the actual first picture book in what we consider the picture book format mm-hmm. nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some debate on that, but because technically a collection of poetry is usually in like the nonfiction and the, you know, it's not really a picture book with a story that you would read at a story time kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's a huge deal because for the most part, it's usually longer books that win this award.
Yeah. It's been, last year was middle grade. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's YA pretty often.
Yeah. Because this award is for, from birth to 14, mm-hmm. age 14. So any book published by an American author published in the United States for the previous year is eligible
mm-hmm.
within that age range.
Mm-hmm.
So it does fit within the age range.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there was, I mean, I don't think there was kerfuffle about, I mean, from some people, I guess, because, like, picture book. And it's like, it's awesome. It's great. But the, I don't even want to call it a debate, but some people brought up that they thought the reason it won was because diversity.
Mm.
Not quality.
Mm.
Diversity. Like, oh, look at this again. That
mm-hmm.
once again, we have people are bitching about diversity.
Right.
And now, yet again, they get the Newbery. Like, I won a prize. You know, like, I ain't getting anything. But, and saying that it didn't deserve it. And where do you think this conversation stems from? Because then we get into the whole idea of excellence, right?
Right.
And everyone kind of is portioning out what excellence is. So this can't be excellent, this particular book, because it's diverse, rather than it's just a good book.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you both think just this mindset is coming from? I mean, people are really psyched. It's like, oh man, Kwame won last year, and Jackie was an honoree, and CeCe Bell last year, and now Matt De La Pena and Christian Robinson, and it was the first time someone who was Latino won the Newbery, which is huge.
Yes.
Do you think this is just kind of like sour grapes, or that there's this lack of differentiation that as soon as you bring up something that's diverse, it becomes judged on a completely different level, and it can't be judged as equally as something that's non-diverse?
Well, I think that when it comes to that word excellence, we have to be careful about what lens we're looking through.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have this canon, right?
Mm-hmm.
This canon, quote-unquote, and we judge excellence based on this canon. And so what when we compare what's coming out, we all, or reviewers and librarians and people who read and evaluate books, all of us have our own definition of what excellence is or what it may be. But for the most part, we tend to be stuck in what we think excellent works are. And my definition of excellence may not always necessarily be the definition of excellence that has been upheld for the past thousands of years, where the dominant culture is the one who, for the most part, has dictated what excellence is. So this picture book, many people take a look at that because there's like colloquial language. The little boy talks about how come, and we all know that's not correct English or whatever. But it's so childlike. It captures the child's imagination. It captures a child's language so perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's not grammatically correct, are we not calling it excellent? Because for that reason. So I think we just have to be very careful on how we define excellent. And, you know, the dominant way it's been defined, maybe it's time to turn that around. I guess because we're so used to the same types of books winning these awards.
Yes.
You know, that when a book is not like that book, you know, the Newbery, I love the Newbery. I used to love reading those books with the medals and stuff. But for the most part, they're usually spunky little white Southern girls, you know, who find themselves or make a friend or, you know, talk to their dog or something like that.
white boys and their dog.
And, you know, I love those books, too.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because I found I was a quirky little Dominican girl, mm-hmm. and I like to talk to animals.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't I like to read that book? But that's not the only type of excellence.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it kind of weirds me out because it's very one-sided conversation. You can't argue with the wall. So mm-hmm. you bring up diversity, which is a term that can be a little controversial for some. And someone says, well, the crossover one, and that was an awesome book. And it's like, well, I didn't think it was all that great. And it's like, okay, that's cool. So then, okay, are you saying it's not great because?
Right.
Or you're not down with poetry? Or,
right, yeah.
Well, what is it? And it's interesting that, like you're saying, the discussion, people making it about race.
Mm-hmm.
When it wasn't about race at all.
Right.
It was just like, this is a book with a kid with his nana.
Exactly.
And yeah. That's it. Mm-hmm. And y'all are freaking out.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just, diversity is not a trend. It's not a buzzword. It's not going away.
No.
Because we're not going away.
And that the marginalization extends because it becomes a whole POC-dominated discussion, I feel mm-hmm. like. And I do worry about that because there is obviously the intersectionality that we also have mm-hmm. to consider. And that's also gets lost in the conversation yeah. mm-hmm. of diversity, where people are just looking at the outward diversity, because mm-hmm. that's helpful, you know? It's
just like, yeah.
Well, I could show that right. I got some POCs. I can't show that I got a disabled person.
Right.
Right.
And, you know, then that becomes its own kind of weird oppression Olympics of, well, I need to see your diversity in order to monetize
yeah.
mm-hmm. on your diversity.
Yeah.
Which yeah. is very disconcerting.
It is. Well. It really yes. is. It really is. And, I mean, I think the more people are vocal, the more allies that mm-hmm. become more vocal, and the more groups work with each other mm-hmm. and not against each other, mm-hmm. And also recognize the fact that there are so many intersectionalities, mm-hmm. you know, that mm-hmm. the religion is a big part of diversity, that, mm-hmm. it, you know... your sexuality is a big part of diversity, mm-hmm. and all of those things are reflected in today's world. So why shouldn't they be reflected in today's books mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. the people who create those books?
Mm-hmm. I want to also want to bring up because a couple of disabled authors had brought this up about the Schneider,
mm-hmm.
which is an award that actually is one of the few that gives an award to someone who may not be of the background that they're mm-hmm. representing. Whereas the Coretta Scott King and the Pura Belpré and the Stonewall
mm-hmm.
have those kind of regulations, but the Schneider doesn't. And that's kind of odd, because then that kind of hits the disabled community of...
Mm.
It broadens the pool, but it also narrows in terms of the representation of what can win.
Right.
Or right. does win.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, that's definitely a big question, And I think all of these associations that award these shiny medals,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's time for us to evaluate mm-hmm. our criteria. It's time for us to evaluate those who can participate within these committees.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, otherwise, the people who are diverse within your organization, they may not feel like they want to do anything about it. Mm-hmm. If the awards that we hold up so high
mm-hmm.
are not changing,
mm-hmm.
you know, so why mm-hmm. should the profession change?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's true.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been good to see the winners of the Newbery change, but I have noticed that the Prince hasn't been that diverse.
Yeah.
I know that's
yeah.
not anyone's fault in this
right,
room.
Right.
But, you know, it's,
yeah.
I mean, again, the Newbery is the pinnacle
mm-hmm.
of the
mm-hmm.
Youth Media Awards. So it's like, yeah, fine with that. But right. it's still disappointing to see, like, oh, the Prince still
yeah,
isn't diverse. And there's diverse young adult out there.
There definitely
too.
Is.
So.
The Prince is a really weird award. I feel like it's the type of award you can never call.
Mm-hmm.
Like every, I mean, it's been around not that long compared to the other
oh,
ones.
Yeah?
I forget how long, how many years. But it's just one of those awards that's like a head scratcher every year.
It's kind of just thrown in there. It's like, we need a YA one. Just put that in print. Make that.
Yeah. And it's, you know, like 1 year, everyone thinks it's going to be this book. And then, of course, that book doesn't even make it on the list. And, and a book that no one's ever heard of is like on it. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, it really, every committee is different. So, I'm not sure what can be done to change that. But I think as librarians become more aware of the need for diverse books, hopefully these awards also follow suit.
So the criteria is you have to be a librarian to even...
For most of these awards. Or at least a member of ALA. Or YALSA. Or in the specific committee that's like in charge of that specific award.
Yeah, sometimes with the Pulitzer you can kind of call it.
And these ALA awards, I mean, that it just shows us another way that librarians are so powerful. Because you know that the book that gets the Newbery and the Caldecott, the publisher is calling that same morning, extend that print run. Because these are the books that are going to go crazy, even in the retail market, not just the school library market. So librarians are the ones, for the most part, who give those awards and pretty much guarantee that a book is going to be in print for the rest of its existence.
Well, Jackie Whitson had said stickers are good.
They are.
She said stickers help.
They really do.
And that was one of the things she noted about the importance of the Coretta Scott King. Was once that was created, it kind of, you know, this nice glossy laminate on your book, and it's like, I know Coretta Scott's King, you know, and it encourages it. So she said these awards, particularly diverse awards, are important because it kind of gives this extra stamp of approval that they're not getting from, I hate to say mainstream, but majority culture. Because, you know, and it's not a segregation, it's just, well, I'm not getting the Newbery, so I'm going to get the Coretta Scott, and people are going to know this is excellence for this. The Pura Belpré is excellence for this, and so on and so forth. So do you think there's an importance to having diverse awards, too?
Yeah, I mean, I think, especially when so many diverse books weren't being awarded, I just think it's also dangerous where a lot of people who are on the committees, and, you know, you are honor-bound not to think this way, but who knows what goes on in somebody's mind when they cast their vote. And, you know, I've never been on the Newbery or the Caldecott, but I would hope that I would never think, oh, well, if this doesn't win the Newbery, it has a chance at the Pura Belpré. It has a chance at the Coretta Scott King. And, you know, I hope that's not what goes through people's minds who are on these committees. But who is to say that it doesn't?
Also, SLJ and LJ do a lot with... There's been more posts on diversity. And forgive me because I am kind of new to the SLJ game as within the past 2-3 years. So with things like there's that whole section we talk about... religious diversity in lit specifically, which I think is very needed because it's also lost a lot in the diversity conversation.
It is.
As well. And so when did those come about? Those types of focused diversity posts? Was it kind of around the time We Need Diverse Books, which is around the time when Chris and Walter Dean did their New York Times post, which has gone viral at this point?
Well, I mean, funnily enough, because our May 2014 print issue was dedicated completely to diversity, and we started working on our editorial calendars almost a year before the next year. So that obviously was in the works way before the whole WNDB hashtag happened. And... probably even before the Walter Dean Myers, Chris Myers, New York Times piece.
Yeah, because theirs was like a month or two before.
So I think at SLJ and LJ, like we've always tried to serve that population, because our customers, our librarians, our readers serve all kinds of populations.
Mm-hmm.
And we try to serve our audience as best as we can. And our audience asks for that,
mm-hmm.
because those are the kids and the patrons that they come in contact with every day.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to say, though, it's not a coincidence that in the past few years we've been seeing more articles and features and mm-hmm. programs about diversity around the same time that the staff at SLJ has become more diverse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think that's a coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't. And, you know, our executive editor, Kathy Ishizuka, and, you know, she's been here for a very long time. And this has always been a passion for her,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of the editors here. So once you have people of color in places of power, you know, these kind of decisions, I think, follow suit
mm-hmm.
thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
We've always been serving that audience, but it definitely helps when you actually have people of color and of diverse backgrounds on staff. And I think of all the review journals, I don't know the exact count
mm-hmm.
of the people in those staffs, but mm-hmm. I think out of all the review journals, we are the most diverse.
Zetta Elliott, she recently had something posted
mm-hmm.
in SLJ, and might be controversial to some people. Zetta was a previous guest, and she was noting, you know, kind of the, I don't want to say disparity, but just the difference
mm-hmm.
when you're a self-published author. And she speaks a lot about this as someone who's been traditionally published and self-published,
mm-hmm.
about the control you have, about feeling locked out, about
mm-hmm.
feeling penalized
mm-hmm.
when you're a self-published author, especially if you're taking it seriously as a business and it's not,
right.
I just like writing poetry
yeah.
about things and
mm-hmm.
I'm going to publish it and it's going to look like crap and... hopefully you'll pay 99 cents for it. Something that Zetta's actively said is the need for self-published books to be reviewed.
Mm.
And considering that, and I don't know the numbers, I mean, people say, they're like, oh, more people of color, more marginalized people tend to self-publish than get traditionally published.
Mm.
I wouldn't be surprised because the filters aren't there, but I don't necessarily know the numbers in terms of, like, people who are straight, white,
right.
abled versus people who are marginalized, what those numbers are. But do you think that more people or more periodicals really should review self-published stuff? Kirkus does the thing where people have to pay.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a self-published
mm-hmm.
author, you have to pay for your review.
Right.
And you mm-hmm. can opt if you want to see that online or if you want to take the feedback and just revise.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you think that should be an option? Or I know the particulars get really fuzzy because thousands of books get published a year, and I can imagine how many more thousands get published
yeah,
by
yeah.
self-published
yeah.
authors.
I mean,
yeah.
Well, LJ
yeah.
has a selfie program, so... And I think Selfie developed because of a lot of our librarians and libraries were saying, you know, we have these self-published authors in our communities that we'd love to celebrate in some kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these self-published authors would like their book to appear in their local library.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of a platform where local libraries can adopt and include in their own collection
mm-hmm.
books that are self-published that have been kind of given, like, the LJ stamp of approval.
Yep.
Kind
yeah,
of that's what it seems
yeah.
that they need. Is
mm-hmm.
Technically, a publisher is a stamp of approval, even
mm-hmm,
though
yeah.
it cannot be your cup of tea at all.
Right,
yes.
But when you're self-published, there's that extra level that you need to be
mm-hmm.
considered legit.
Right.
Yeah.
And as we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, many libraries do need a review in order
mm-hmm.
to make a purchase and include a book within or a material within the collection. So if, you know, if something is included in the selfie, what do they call it, a pod or something?
Cool.
So
yeah.
so the library can say, oh, this, you know, has been looked at
mm-hmm.
at least by a professional reviewer,
mm-hmm.
a magazine, LJ, that we recognize.
Mm-hmm.
That means that we can add it to our collection. And it's available, I think, to that local library.
So, for the self-pub people out there, let me see if I have this straight. Librarians technically need reviews for the most part before mm-hmm. they can justify a purchase for their collection.
Yeah.
What if it's the second book in a best-selling trilogy? Is that automatic or?
Do you mean like a traditionally published second yeah, book? Or? For the most part, I think both of them are magazines because of the limitation of space. We mostly review only the first book of the series, mm-hmm. unless it's like a really big series.
Right.
And, mm-hmm. Maybe we'll review the second. We very rarely review like the third, the fourth, the 16th. You
right.
know, Magic Treehouse mm-hmm. 108.
Right.
You know,
so if you already have like the first 10, you're going to buy number 11. So
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you could always refer to the first review of the mm-hmm. first book.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I know that people have said that requesting the book is helpful. So if I requested a self-published book, would that help at all, or no? You'd still need those reviews, potentially.
I mean, what do you think? I haven't worked in a library myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure.
I would think, like, your local independent bookstore, you know, if you really want a book, you can request, and because they want to serve you, want to keep you as a customer,
yeah. mm-hmm.
they would do that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think if enough people request a particular title, so mm-hmm. if a self-pub mm-hmm. author gets mm-hmm. their whole family and church group and,
yeah.
you know, to do that, like, I would think a librarian would at least follow through and check it out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I'm trying to think of just the logistical aspect, because I think people... And it was good with the previous episode with Ebony Liddell demystifying marketing and publicity and mm-hmm. what big publishers will do for you, not what mm-hmm. not to expect.
Right.
And I'd like to also demystify this whole library process of they're not trying to keep you out, mm-hmm. they're not being actively like, I don't want your books or anything like that, but there's this process to it and there are limitations
yeah.
mm-hmm. as well.
Especially yeah. with limited budgets.
Admittedly, I'm not looking for them, but I very rarely see a self-published book
mm-hmm.
yeah.
in the New York public library system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. yeah. And, you know, at SLJ, we're also, we're starting this new column mm-hmm. written by Amy Martin, who's a librarian, in, I think, in the San Francisco area, mm-hmm. who has a special interest in self-published children's books.
Cool.
So that's kind of how we've been directing, you know, any calls or requests from self-published authors.
Mm-hmm.
We've been sending them to her, and she's going to start writing a column of select books, self-published books that, you know, that she feels are good enough to be included in a library.
Mm.
And even SLJ, we've kind of been loosening up our requirements when it comes to self-published things, but they have to be the same, they have to follow the same guidelines that are traditional published books that we review. So, you know, we have specific guidelines. We mostly review pre-publication. So you can't send us a self-published book that was published 3 months ago. Like, you have to send it with a few months in advance before your publication date. So, and it has to look like a published book. You know, it has to have a cover, and we always ask for like a pub slip. And so if they follow the requirements that we give the traditional publishers, mm-hmm. then we are more likely to take it seriously. Mm-hmm. And to consider it.
And it has to be print bound.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know.
You know, we're in New York and, you know, the metropolitan area, like yeah. we would never think about something like that. But, you know, yeah. in other communities, mm-hmm. having a shelf of LGBT, you know, mm-hmm. or even being shelved within the larger collection, that's mm-hmm. asking for like a war.
Well, thank you both so much for being on the podcast and talking more about this aspect of the industry that I think has been lacking sorely in
yes.
conversation. So in terms of how people may contact you, if you want them to, how can people reach you online?
Well, for me, I think it's the easiest. Twitter, mm-hmm. SDS101. That's just the fastest and probably the first thing that I'll respond to.
Okay. Me too.
Yeah, so. And we are actively seeking reviewers, mm-hmm. especially diverse reviewers. So if anyone's interested in reviewing for SLJ or LJ, reach out to either of us and
yes.
we'll be happy to give you more info.
Please do.
Yeah,
yes.
And one of the things that we hope to do this summer for our reviewers is create a self-directed course on reviewing books, diverse books, and how not to do it, how to do it, and the questions that arise. So
that's great. So Thank you again.
Sure, yes, thank you.
No problem.
So much. I've said so 28 times during this episode. So again, if you follow the podcast on Tumblr, it's minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com, Minorities in Pub on Twitter, and also the podcast is on iTunes, and I keep forgetting to ask people to rate it. So if you're on iTunes and you listen to the podcast, feel free to rate it.
Rate it. Yeah.
But you subscribing is enough for me. Thank you.